Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. In neighborhoods around the country and here in the Bay Area, residents are beginning to step up to help keep their communities safe, even when official institutions fall short. On today's show, we're speaking with two groups on opposite ends of the country who are working at the grassroots level to offer some much-needed interventions. In Oakland, California, ambulances can be slow to arrive, or first responders can be slow to summon them, and that can endanger critically injured victims. In 2011, activists started teaching one another in that community how to save lives. They created what's called the People's Community Medics, and they train residents of all ages to offer first aid in the cities of Oakland, San Francisco, Richmond, Berkeley, and continued into Oxnard, California, along with now Chicago, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon. On the other end of the country, in New York City, neighbors are organizing to end gun violence. The homicide numbers have actually been on a steady decline, but last year alone, there were more than 90 homicides in Brooklyn alone. So neighbors there in Brooklyn have started taking action with what's called the Save Our Streets program. They send out outreach volunteers who mediate the conflicts that could end up in violence, and then they act as peer counselors to people who are at risk of committing or being victims of violence. So today we're going to talk about what the needs are specifically around violence that are not being met in local communities by established institutions. We're going to talk about how communities are figuring out how to meet those needs themselves, and where these groups, these self-appointed folks, can go from here. A little bit later, we're going to be talking with Tiffany Murray, and she is the Bedford-Stuyvesant New York Program Manager for Save Our Streets, Neighbors in Action. It's a violence prevention group in New York City. But first, we're going to start right here in our studio with Sharina Thomas. She's one of the co-founders of People's Community Medics, and the organization is exactly what it says. She teaches residents how to go about treating gunshot victims right on the scene, literally helping bleeding trauma victims even before the paramedics arrive. Sharina, amazing work. It's so good to have you here. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Let's start by talking about the need for rapid emergency response. For example, in Alameda County, where Oakland is located, there was a report compiled by the county's Emergency Services Division that showed that ambulances arrive about 7 minutes after firefighters arrive. So the fire department dispatch records that it can take up to 90 minutes in some parts of Alameda County for ambulances to arrive because sometimes they're just downright unavailable. So, Sharina, give us a sense of where emergency response services in Oakland are falling short of what the community needs.
Wow. Well, I live in East Oakland, and I am in the area where it takes the 90 minutes for the EMTs to get there. I beg to differ to say that EMTs is not available at that time. I believe that the problem is that the police is not dispatching and saying that it's safe for the EMTs to come into the community to assist.
So who's dropping the ball? The police are afraid to enter an area and bring the paramedics and ambulances in for fear of additional gunfire? Or what's the delay?
No, the delay is the communication between the police and the people in the community. If there's people crying and upset about someone being hurt, bleeding to death, the police deem that unsafe. It doesn't matter if the person is still, the killer may not be around. They're not observing for a killer at that point. They're just standing here while someone's loved one is bleeding to death. And what that is called is called death enforcement. It's not a written policy that the police do, but it is something that happens so regular and it's common in our community where they delay entry for the EMTs to come and assist.
So the most recent stats that I have in front of me are for 2014. Do you have anything more recent in terms of the response time for these ambulances?
Yes, I do. And like maybe, I want to say maybe 6 months ago, there was a horrible accident over there off of 35th Avenue in East Oakland. There was a little girl in the car. A family on their way, I think from Bible study or something like that. But the accident was horrific, and it took the ambulance over an hour to get there, and the police was there. The police had combed off the area. We had maybe like 60 police like around and like trying to do crowd control versus trying to save the lives of the victims that was in the car. And on top of that, they got in between me being a first responder and told me that if I continued to assist in trying to save the life, that they would arrest me.
So you're saying that this is a deliberate policy, whether it's written or unwritten, on the part of the police department, in this case the Oakland Police Department, where if they feel like they are not safe, they don't call in medics.
Right, but they be safe. Don't nobody mess with them. They be safe, and it's the victim who's not safe at this point. Like, if someone is shot, they're down there bleeding to death, and the police is just standing there, and they don't try to assist. The police carry a quick clot in their trunks of their car. They have kits. We pay, our tax dollars pay for them to actually save lives, and they don't use it. They don't use the kits either.
Have you ever coordinated with the departments, whether it's Richmond or Oxnard or San Francisco or Oakland or Berkeley? Do you, as a first responder and your group, actually, do the police even know that you exist?
The police know that People's Community Medics exist? And no, I have not coordinated anything with any police ever, and I probably never will, and I never will. I won't coordinate the People's Community Medics with the police. I'm just more concerned about the community.
But wouldn't that help for you to work hand in hand with them so that they know when you guys arrive on a scene that you're there to help before an ambulance arrives?
They know that that's what I'm there for. If I have my kit and I have my medical equipment and I tell them who I am, they know who I am. They know what I'm doing.
So you have an ID or something that shows who you are and what you're there for?
No, I announce who I am, and pretty much they know. And I like not all the time that they have stopped me from saving a life. So that's not the issue. The issue is that while I'm there saving a life, they don't okay the EMTs to come. And it takes a long time for the EMTs to get to the victims.
Have you actually been able to save lives?
Yes, ma'am.
The family that you described who had been in the car accident, did they survive?
No.
They did not?
No. But I was able to be there and pray with the little girl. And I was there to pray with the young lady, and I tried to keep her conscious as long as I could because the police, you know.
Wow. I can't imagine what would give someone an inkling that they could do this kind of work. At the top of the show, I was asking, you know, would you be willing to help a neighbor in a situation where they were suffering from a gunshot wound? And the answer, I think, for most folks, quite frankly, Sharina, is, I don't think I have it in me. What made you think you did?
I was born to do it. My parents were like that. I grew up in a family that helped the community. Mm-hmm. And my mom was a first responder. And I watched her, you know, in the hood, just actually run into accidents and people having seizures or whatever the community needed, my mom just always kind of helped out. And I just saw her do it so many years, and I grew up with it. It's just instilled in me.
Why the tears?
I cry because, you know, they're happy tears because I was brought up right, you know. I saw a lot, and my mom did a lot, and I'm just grateful. I'm just grateful to be where I'm at and able to do what I'm doing.
Well, there's certainly a special calling on your life. By the same token, what you do as a community medic practitioner is the end result of what happens when violence pervades a community. I think we're joined now by Tiffany Murray. She is the Bedford-Stuyvesant Program Manager for Save Our Streets Neighbors in Action. It's a violence prevention group in New York City. So Tiffany was just able to join us from Bed-Stuy. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi. How's everybody doing?
Hey. So Shireen is here, and I hope you were able to kind of hear just the beginning of what we were talking about. And Shireena and folks like her have formed the People's Community Medics, and they go out into the community and literally become first responders before the medics can arrive. But you work closely with people who are at risk of becoming victims or people who are at risk of perpetrating gun violence. And you work in these neighborhoods that are deeply impacted. Gang members are becoming peer counselors and literally violence interrupters. Can you talk a bit, Tiffany, about your work?
Yes. So I had been a volunteer for about 3 years prior to becoming a program manager for SOS Bed-Stuy. A lot of the work that we do is to try to prevent the violence from happening. And I was listening to, is it Shireena? I was listening to her story about her experience in Oakland, and I was just heartbroken because that is not our experience. We've spent a lot of years establishing ourselves as Cure Violence, which is looking at violence from a public health approach, and really getting ourselves deeply rooted into the infrastructure of the city. We have currently, I think, 21, maybe 22 sites across the city where we are responsible for a set amount of blocks that we monitor and patrol in ways that through building relationships and the community trusting us that we are there for them. And we actually have entity that's similar to People's Community Medics. It's called the Bed-Stuy Volunteer EMT service that they have. And it's a really good service. But the point of what we do is we try to get the high-risk individuals, whether that's the person who is the shooter, who has shot someone in the past, or just who has shot a gun, who has access to a gun, who's a part of a gang, crew, or set. Whether that could be formal or informal, because not all little groups of individuals are a formal, what you would call gang, but they just hang out together. And a lot of what we find in Bed-Stuy in particular is that, unfortunately, it's the younger ones that instigate incidents of fighting and threats of violence on social media. However, it's the older ones, the 25 to 35 year olds, that are actually the shooters in our community. And we're not we're not heavily gang. We have gangs, but they're not as formal and active in our particular catchment as per se other parts of the city. Like Crown Heights is our sister site, and they do have heavy gang activity within their catchment area. And so they utilize individuals from that community who have made their life change, and they have decided that they want to heal the very community that they may have participated in hurting in the past. And so in our catchment, because gangs are not as big of a thing, the Bed-Stuy team is made up of individuals who are not formal gang members, but instead have, again, been a part of hurting their community in the past. And so what they do is they leverage relationships within the community to build trust, so that way individuals will tell them about conflicts before they occur. And if there's any way that we can de-escalate those conflicts, we do that. So we have a team made up of violence interrupters, and that's all they focus on is building those relationships and stopping conflicts. And then you have outreach workers who hold a caseload of individuals who we consider high risk and help them to get connected to things like, you know, education, therapeutic services, jobs or job training, whatever it is that we can help them to do via mentorship and coaching to help them change their lives and turn them around. And so that's what our focus is.
Well, I see Sharina, she's nodding. I think whether it's Bedford-Stuyvesant or Oakland, you recognize this kind of intervention, and you're hoping that that very kind of intervention would literally put you and your medics out of business, yes?
Well, yes, I do. I hope that. But, like, the People's Community Medics is... Put it like this. I don't even look at our people that even hang together as gangs or cliques or nothing like that, because I come from a big family, and sometimes my family, if they coming over to my house, if you consider 5 or 10 young black males hanging together, you know, gangs or something that may have something suspicious, I just don't. I just train everybody, anybody, like, it doesn't matter what they got going on in their life. Like, kids, I talk to kids. I get kids to not do no violence. Like, when you go to the schools and you talk to the kids and you tell them, you know, you train them on how to save a life, they don't take lives. I get kids to pledge to do no harm. So if there's things that happen, you know, like, if things happen in their life along the way, those children that I teach in their classes don't go out and have those guns to shoot and cause those types of issues that her group is already involved in helping. Mm-hmm. You know?
So you, Sharina Thomas of the People's Community Medics, and you, Tiffany Murray of Save Our Streets and Neighbors in Action, both of you are engaged on some level in intervention and prevention.
Right.
And I want to invite listeners to give us a call if you have questions about the function of both of these organizations. 866-798-8255 is the number. Your call at kalw.org if you wanted to drop us a line. Tiffany, your model is something that's based on Cure Violence, which started in Chicago, and it was based on an epidemiological study of infectious diseases, and they found that they started looking at pockets of violence, not around what we tend to associate with gangs and, you know, this whole version of, you know, folks who are engaged in organized gang activity, but it was actually more like an outbreak of disease. So there's a reason why Cure Violence is part of the name of your organization. You're treating this violence as a public health issue. So how is that approach different from, say, a law enforcement model?
So we're interested in meeting the person where they are currently. So we're not trying to enforce the law. What we're trying to do is get you to change your life so that one, you're healthier, you have better life outcomes and successes, and then that the community is better. So then the community has better outcomes and successes for the future. So everything we function off of is anonymity. So we don't have anything in our computers. We don't have anything on papers, mm-hmm. anything that will identify individuals or where they live. The community trusts us to tell us information because we do not share information with the police. We have what we call a peaceful coexistence or a respectful coexistence. So we confirm data from the police, but we do not share information with the police. Mm. And it's gotten to be that in our particular precinct, and it's not this way in all across the city, but in our precinct, which is the 79th precinct in Brooklyn, we're able to, you know, get what we need. And some of the officers have seen the effectiveness of our work firsthand. And so instead of just arresting our kids, sometimes they'll just call myself or one of the upper managers and say, hey, you know, we got kids over here in this area and they look like they're trying to get into some stuff. Can somebody come over here and address that and get them off the block? And we've done that. And the community has calmed down quite tremendously in one of the hottest areas in the blocks or in intersections in the city, which is Gates and Marcy and Bed-Stuy.
Well, I find it interesting, Tiffany Murray of Save Our Streets, that both you and Sharina seem to be have made a deliberate decision to work parallel to law enforcement, not in conjunction with law enforcement. Now, the casual observer might think that it might be that you actually are a little suspect of traditional law enforcement. Sharina, is that accurate or no?
What do you mean, suspect?
Well, just as Tiffany said, you know, that sometimes, you know, or even you who said, it might just be me and the members of my family who are out, and the police might misidentify. They aren't culturally plugged in enough to really do the kind of work that we do. So are police part of the problem in some way, Sharina?
I want to say yes. They're part of the problem, and a lot of the police that serves in our community is not from our community. They have no kind of ties with the people in our community, and I feel that they don't care if our people live or die in our community.
Tiffany, does that parallel what your experience has been in terms of working with formal law enforcement in your work?
It depends. Some officers genuinely came into the job because they want to help people, which means that they're willing to go the extra mile and build relationships and actually get to know the communities that they serve. And then, of course, you got the officers who just don't care, and they see communities of color or minority communities as problematic, and so they will treat us as such. But one thing we got to always remember is that the role of the police is to enforce the law, not to build relationships, not to prevent violence. They're the ones that come after the fact. And so our role, I think, is more so to be preventative and to try to bring an actual resolution and true healing to the community. That's not their focus. That's our focus. And so that makes a big difference in the actions that our two entities take. We're trying to heal. They're trying to enforce. And that's a very different perspective.
Well, this approach, the idea of curing violence and treating it as an epidemiological issue, you changed your model and looked at this problem differently. Is the problem that the police aren't, in fact, looking at their jobs differently? I mean, I was under the impression, because so many major cities speak about the community, you know, foot patrols and engagement and meeting with community leaders and, you know, collaboration with communities. Are you saying that that just isn't happening, Tiffany?
It is happening for some areas, but it still comes down to that individual officer. There, let's be honest, all of us bring our own biases, our own prejudices, our own views, cultural, social, economical, religious, into any arena that we enter. As long as we're there, so are our beliefs. Some people are able to separate and being open to learning about some, about others who are different, about cultures, about communities that are different, and finding ways to connect as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Not every person is open to that. So what you're going to find is that some people genuinely are going to maintain their beliefs because they just don't view the people that they serve as being just as worthy of protection and service as someone who looks like them. And so some of the officers, it's been very helpful for them. But the reality is the NYPD in particular needs to do more to really help officers understand to not be afraid of the people that don't look like them and try to actually understand the communities and cultures in which they serve in.
We're talking today about communities taking emergency response into their own hands with Sharina Thomas of the People's Community Medics here in Oakland, and Tiffany Murray with Save Our Streets Neighbors in Action in Bedford-Stuyvesant, New York. And we invite your participation. When we come back, we're going to actually go through one of the kits that the community medics actually use when they come out to a scene. And we hope you'll stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can listen to past shows there and sign up for the newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. On the next Your Call tomorrow, we talk with artists who are part of an art installation called The Question Bridge. It's a video platform that's designed to help explore and redefine Black male identity. The idea is to counteract the negative perceptions of Black men. These artists are creating an art space where the complex images of Black men can live and be seen. So the question is, how are artists now beginning to tackle the idea of dismantling harmful racist stereotypes about Black men? That's on tomorrow's Your Call with me, Renee Kemp, and you. Today, we are talking with Sharina Thomas of the People's Community Medics here in Oakland, and Tiffany Murray with Save Our Streets Neighbors in Action from Bedford-Stuyvesant. If you have questions or input, 866-798-8255 is the number. Sharina, you brought me a packet. It's a medium-sized baggie. Tell me what's in it. This is what you take out to a scene when you and your community medics show up.
This is what I take to a training. Mm-hmm. When I get ready to train people, this is the package that I give out. Mm-hmm. When I go out to a scene, these are the things that I do step by step when I'm approaching a scene. Mm-hmm. It's inside my packet. I have... Can I back up 1 minute?
Sure you can.
I just got to stop, and I got to give a shout out. The People's Community Medics was not just formed by me. Mm-hmm. People's Community Medics was formed by another person, and her name is Leslie Taisha Phillips. Mm-hmm. She is the other co-founder of the People's Community Medics, and I just want to, like, put that in perspective.
And
that
you've been
it's
doing
not
this
just me.
How many years?
Since 2011. Mm-hmm. She and I were members of the Oscar Grant Committee. Mm. And she and I, and so that's how People's Community Medics started.
Well, as a matter of fact, it came directly after the Oscar Grant situation. You want to just kind of explain how that played into your decision to create this community medics function?
That would be cool. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So Leslie, Taisha Phillips, and I met with doing the same thing, but on different teams at the time. Mm-hmm. She was a part of the Oscar Grant Committee, and I was fighting for justice for my brother, Antoine Thomas, who was locked up for a crime that he didn't do. Mm-hmm. And so she and I met and joined together. Mm-hmm. From that day point, I joined the Oscar Grant Committee, and she and I was a part of the steering committee. Mm-hmm. And during that time, we were invited to do an independent investigation of Oscar Grant's murder. Mm-hmm. And in that independent investigation of Oscar Grant's murder, we asked some questions, like real questions, like about our community, because we was told that, you know, the bullet wounds that pierced Oscar Grant's body, there's no way that he could have lived by that.
So you found evidence that law enforcement neglected to call an ambulance after Oscar Grant was shot. Is that right?
That is correct. Like, mm-hmm. 20 minutes, mm-hmm. before they even called. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 60 minutes is the golden hour for somebody to bleed to death. And, you know, so during that investigation, we knew that part was not. But being that I was that kid that was sitting there while my mom assisted people in the hood, people of color, people that are deemed scary, my mom was out there doing that. And I would watch the police be there, and I would watch the EMTs be on the corner. I never knew why. And that was a question that bothered me from a kid growing all the way up. Mm-hmm. And when I got a chance to ask that whistleblower, why is it that it takes so long for the EMTs to come? Why is it? Because I watch my mom and I watch people in the hood and I know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Why does it take so long? And they said, that's what he told me. He told us, you know, it's not a written policy, and that's death enforcement, because they have to wait until the police okay for them to come in and save a life. The police don't even allow our people to get prayed over, you know, even knowing that they're going to die. They don't let kids get prayed over. They don't even let us, like, even... It dehumanized them so much to the point to where, like, you know, like in the movies, you see the police, like, leaning over and the victim get to say who shot them. The police don't even do that. They don't even come in contact with the person that is shot. They don't even care. They just pretty much don't.
So you don't call it law enforcement. You call it death enforcement.
It's death enforcement because they can actually save a life, and they don't. Like, say for instance, all they have to do is pop the trunk of their car. We pay for them to be trained. That's why I say they don't care, because they can use the very kiss that's in the trunk of their car and save a life. Not stand around and joke and mimic the people that are sitting there crying. They consider the people that sit near crying like a danger to the community. The people that I find that stand around are the people that want to help. Like, if I come out there to a scene and somebody shot, I can ask everybody that's standing around there to ask to participate in saving that person's life. They may not know what to do, and they may just only be looking for direction to find what to do.
And I'm once again have one of the kits here that you use to train. But let's go to the calls that we have. Let's start with Jonah in Hayward. Hi, Jonah. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
So I totally agree with the approach that both sides are taking in Brooklyn and in Oakland. I just want to make a point that a lot of the holdbacks that the police make the paramedics do are sometimes profiling. I had a cousin who was, you know, a known gang member, was actually on the straight and narrow at this point in his life, got into an altercation at a house party, was shot premeditatedly by the other individual who happened to be white, and the police, when they arrived on the scene, they recognized who he was. They laughed, and then they held the ambulance. After he took his last breath, they let the ambulance through.
Mm.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just sometimes them doing crowd control. Sometimes it's personal. You got to deal with the human factor.
And Sharina is nodding her head in the affirmative. You mentioned, Sharina, that the police have something called clot stop, that they could stanch the bleeding. They could do what you and your community medics do, but they don't very often.
Right. They at the point where when Leslie and I first co-founded People's Community Medics in 2011, we didn't have quick clot at that point. We had just the knowledge and knew, like, we developed some of the tools and stuff that we need. But the police have quick clot. It's called quick clot. Mm-hmm. It stops the person from bleeding to death instantly. It stops the person from bleeding to death. It actually really saves lives, and they don't use it. And it baffles me because, like, they do have a disconnection with the people in the community. And I get just what he said. Like, I see it, you know, that they do profile. They do profile, and they do put, like, who has value on their life and who don't. If the shoe was on the other foot, if that brother would have shot a white kid, that white kid would have got some medical assistance. He would have got some medical assistance very fast. All you have to do is say you white.
Mm, wow. That's quite an indictment. And, you know, I've heard a lot recently about the use of Narcan to stop a death spiral when someone is dying of opioid abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, very wealthy communities where folks are dying of opioid abuse, police are being trained, everybody's being trained. They're asking people to just carry it in your pocketbook, put it in your back pocket to save lives in that circumstance. But what you're saying is when it's gun violence and the inner city and people of color, there doesn't seem to be that kind of interventionist approach, right?
It's not just even in our hood for gun violence, ma'am. It could be a car accident.
Mm.
It's just where it's located at in the color of our skin. And I believe that wholeheartedly that that's why the response is slower in our community. The police is educated enough to know that it takes 60 minutes for somebody to bleed to death. And if they don't use those skills that we train, that we pay for them to use, they use it on themselves. They use it in the case of Alan Bluford. Have you heard of Alan Bluford?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When Alan Bluford was shot and killed, that baby did not even shoot the police. First up, the police shot himself in the foot. They shot and killed Alan Bluford. They thought he had a gun. He was pulling up his pants, and they thought he had a gun. They shot that kid, and they killed that kid, and they did not use the stuff that they used to help the cop that shot himself in the foot. They used the quick clot to save the man who shot himself in the foot. But they didn't use that for Alan Bluford. And they didn't, like the case of Kenneth Harding out here in San Francisco, Bayview, Hunters Point. When that baby got shot, they knew that he took some fatal wounds, and they still did not allow him to be prayed over. The video shows it. It shows, like, the lack of the empathy for the people in the hood.
Tiffany Murray, Save Our Streets Neighbors in Action. You're organizing to actually end gun violence. The statistics show that homicides are on the decline, but just listening to Sharina, it's not because police are doing any better. Is it that organizations like yours are actually doing a better job in spite of the police, not in conjunction with the police?
I would say that there are a lot of organizations that have stepped up, and plus a component of the work that we do is faith-based relationships. And so what we're starting to see is that more faith communities are coming together to support the work that we're doing and to extend it out as well. In the areas where we are doing the work, you're seeing a decline in a lot of the violence. We were, at one point, things were just constantly happening.
Mm-hmm.
But for, you know, recently, say in the last few months, we've seen a decline in the types of violence that kind of had my team running all over the place for a while. And I could say that in the other precincts where there is a Cure Violence site, that the shootings have gone down tremendously. And I think it's because our focus is to get the community to mobilize and to stand against it. It's not, we're just trying to identify individuals. We are trying to do it community-wide.
Mm-hmm.
And so we involve everybody. So I think that because we are pulling community together in order to be the solution and not just focusing on the problem individuals, we're focusing on those and the community, it makes a difference and it turns things around, definitely.
And Tiffany, you do have some numbers to work with in terms of trying to identify the impact that you're having. The stats show that Neighbors in Action, your group, interrupted more than 100 conflicts. You brokered more than 200 peace agreements. You organized more than 350 group sessions for young men impacted by gun violence. So do those kind of raw numbers help you to evaluate your success? How are you able to measure the impact that you're having?
Well, we use our numbers as well because we are an evidence-based program. But we also pay attention to what's happening in the community. When gun violence is happening, people don't come out. People stay in. You don't see as much activity. The atmosphere in the community is different. So we look at that. We look at the successes of the young people. What are they engaged in? Particularly the ones who have been having problems, whether they're impacted by violence or they have been engaged in violent behaviors. Mm-hmm. When we see them turning corners and making different decisions, getting a job and not hanging out on the block anymore, those are some of the parameters that we also use as kind of like a way to say, hey, you know, this is moving. Or we watch them become unofficial interrupters of violence. They're stopping conflicts from happening. And people are in the community are viewing them different. It's one thing to see somebody be the problem in the community. It's another thing to see that exact same person be the solution. And so those are some of the other parameters that we judge success by.
Well, I think both of your groups work with people in the community, which arguably is kind of a new model. So for those communities that are accustomed to maybe the police coming in and dealing with an issue, your model is different, as is Sharina's. And so why is it important for people with the closest connection to the community and those most affected by gun violence to help end it? So why is it important to have peer counseling in for a violence interrupter to literally be somebody who knows what this is about? Tiffany?
I would say, I would just kind of give an alternative. Our communities of color, have always been community-minded. It has only been since probably in the last 40 years that we shifted, and it's been to our detriment, particularly in the Black community, that we became so concerned with ourselves and stopped caring about community. Mm-hmm. And I think that our focus is to get back to that, get back to being engaged with our community and lifting our community up and being the solution for our own issues. I think the number one thing is that when people know you, when people remember who you used to be, mm-hmm. and can say, wow, you were one of the worst ones out here, mm-hmm. and you're not doing that anymore, and you're saying it lends a credibility that someone who has no experience and no connection to that community is not going to have. And so it's crucial that we have people who people grew up with. So that way when there's a conflict, you know who you need to get in contact with. Mm-hmm. Or within a couple of phone calls, you can say, no, that's so-and-so's cousin, or that's so-and-so's kid, or that's so-and-so's brother or sister. Mm-hmm. Now you know who you need to utilize in that situation to help de-escalate the conflict.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's so many parallels between the work that you're doing, but also in the communities that you're serving. For example, both of these are very much gentrifying areas. I live in Oakland. It's extraordinary to watch what's happening in communities that used to be considered, quote unquote, too violent for people to even consider. But now a one bedroom of a studio will run you $2,300 a month. And it's the same in Bedford-Stuyvesant. We were looking at apartmentlist.com. A one-bedroom apartment rents for around $2,300. In Bed-Stuy, the median household income is more than $50,000. But for long-time residents, people who've been in Bed-Stuy for a generation or two or three, it's only around $28,000. So nearly a third of the households are rent burdened. So I'm wondering, Tiffany, do the issues of gentrification and the displacement of longtime residents, do those issues have any influence on gun violence at all? And the changing
Absolutely.
Numbers?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The reality is that the reason why it's a public health issue is because when you're constantly in a state of desperation and survival, mm-hmm. you make poor decisions. That is diametrically in the reality. If I am struggling to be able to pay my rent, put food on the table, take care of my health, which I might be working two or three jobs to make ends meet because rent just went up another $400. That means that I'm not taking care of myself. I'm pushing myself. Mm-hmm. So my health is going to suffer. Economically, I'm struggling because I'm barely making it. So the same store that used to have lower priced items, now because people who are of higher incomes and most times a different of the white race, they're now raising the prices at the same grocery store you've been shopping at for 20 plus years. Now, instead of paying a couple, like $3 for a bag of fruit, now you got to pay $6. So you're already struggling. You're already trying to figure out how to make it. You're not. So you might get sick. God forbid one of your kids gets sick. Oh my gosh. Now you got to think about how am I going to take care of them? I got to take off of work, which means that's less money coming into the house. Now I've got to figure it out. It's going to spiral into some depression, anger issues, mm-hmm. all types of things. So then when you come across somebody and you get into a conflict, you're not making wise choices. Mm-hmm. You are already at the breaking point before you got into the conflict. You get into the conflict. Now whatever was kind of stirring under the surface has now just erupted.
And this certainly argues for a holistic approach, as you two are taking, prevention and then intervention. Let's go to the phones. Lisa, thank you for holding. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to support the woman from Oakland. I absolutely, as a white person, I had seen the racism in the police department in the East Bay and the privileges that I have been accorded as a white person. Even when I, by mistake, hit somebody with my car when I was making a right turn, a black person, the police treated that person like they were a criminal.
Mm.
It was unbelievable. I was astonished. And I have to say that this is endemic because I go to my neighborhood police association meetings, which is predominantly white, especially now as it's gentrifying more. And it's the white neighbors who are giving the cues to the police to have more police profiling. So us white people need to speak up because the police are acting on our behalf, theoretically.
Wow, Lisa, thank you for that particular perspective. Sharina, again, you are nodding in the affirmative. This does not come as a surprise to you, huh?
It's not a surprise to me. And I would like to, you know, be honest about how all of this is. It's important. Everything that we both groups are doing is very, very necessary. Even though we don't want it to be,
mm-hmm.
it's very necessary to save our people by all means necessary. And you're right. More white people do need to step up. More white people do need to make the police accountable for what they're doing. And because we're not the enemy. And in times, like you just said, in an accident or something like that that you may cause, we, as on approach of the color of our skin, already is deemed guilty of doing something that we may not have done. And so I appreciate her calling in and saying that because it's not like I'm just like attack on the police. I'm attack on the crimes and on the system, the broken system for our people. I'm attacking the system. You know, I'm trying to break the chains. I'm trying to stop what's going on too, what's in between that, the crimes, the killings and all that stuff. The main thing is like adding a cushion between the time that the accident happened and the time that the EMTs arrived. And I'm the one that's stuck right there holding the bullet wounds and watching somebody's kid bleed to death while I'm like two exits away from the hospital. You know, that type of stuff should not happen in no hood, but it happens whether it's gentrified or not. I put it like this. It's the color of our skin. If it was a white person in the hood that got shot and killed, when you call 911 dispatchers, they ask you what color is the person anyway before they even come to our hood.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do.
Well, just as a point of identification of the victim, are you saying that there's that much of a disparity in treatment?
It is.
Wow.
Wow.
Big wow. Yes, Tiffany, are you as stunned by that as I am?
I am. That, I mean, I'm already familiar with the reality that white people move into some of the worst areas of Brooklyn with no fear, because they know that the ramifications are that if a white person gets shot, that the entire community will be turned upside down trying to find the killer. However, I've called 911 in New York City and they don't ask that question. So that is appalling, and that is a clear case of racial profiling, because it should not matter what color the person is. You should be asking about the gravity of the wounds or the incident as to why, or the reason for why you're calling 911.
I should say not. We've got about 2 minutes left. And Sharina, you wanted to say something about what Tiffany just said.
Yeah, Tiffany. It's crazy because I was on the freeway, actually, on 880 going about 60 miles per hour, and there was a guy standing in the middle divider, and I called 911, and they asked me what color was the man standing up there, and I thought he was suicidal. So I'm saying, does it matter what color he is? Can you go save him? What part of that does it matter?
I can't imagine. Yeah. I can't imagine the circumstances that both of you women address every day for being on the front lines, for being proactive.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. You're Tiffany
welcome.
Murray, Bedford-Stuyvesant Program Manager for Save Our Streets, Neighbors in Action, a violence prevention group in New York City. And Sharina Thomas, you're pointing to, with less than a minute.
Oh, yes. If you would like to get your neighborhood trained on People's Community Medics, please call me at area code 510-239-7720, or you can contact me at peoplescommunitymedics@gmail.com, or you can look us up. Please, I'm Sharina Diamond Thomas on Facebook. Link up with me. No matter what state or city you in, we can connect with you and get your hood, your block, your church, your school, your kids trained.
Thank you, Sharina.
You're welcome.
Sharina
Thank
Thomas.
Absolutely.
Passionate co-founder of People's Community Medics, training residents to provide emergency first aid. Thank you, Tiffany. Thank you, Sharina. Laura Winnes is our producer. Joshua Wilner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman, chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.